Osho, the goose is out. Responses to disciples' questions given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 9.
The first question. Bhagavan, is it important to have some kind of attitude towards life? Margaret, the best way to miss life is to have a certain attitude towards it. The attitudes originate in the mind. And life is beyond mind. The attitudes are our fabrications, our prejudices, our inventions. Life is not our fabrication. On the contrary, we are just ripples in the lake of life. What an attitude a ripple in the ocean can have towards the ocean. What an attitude a grass leaf can have towards the earth, the moon, the sun, the stars. All attitudes are egoistic. All attitudes are stupid. Life is not a philosophy. It is not a problem. It is a mystery. You have to live it not according to a certain pattern, not according to a conditioning, not what you have been told about it. You have to start afresh from the very scratch. Each human individual should think as if he is the first on the earth. He is the Adam or the Eve. Then you can open. You can open to infinite possibilities. Then you will be vulnerable, available. And the more vulnerable you are, the more available you are, the more is the possibility of life happening to you. Your attitudes function like barriers. Then life never reaches to you as it is. It has to fit to your philosophy, religion, ideology. And in that very fitting, something dies in it. What you get out is a corpse. It may look like life, but it is not. That's what people have been doing down the ages. The Hindus are living according to the Hindu attitudes. the Mohammedans according to the Mohammedan attitude, and the communists according to the communist attitude. But remember a basic fundamental truth. The attitude does not allow you to come in contact with life as it is. It distorts. It interprets. There is an old Greek story. A fanatic king had a beautiful golden bed, very precious, studded with thousands of diamonds. And whenever a guest will be in the palace, he will offer the bed to the guest. But he had a certain attitude. The guest has to fit with the bed. If the guest was a little longer, then the king will cut him to size. Of course, the bed was so valuable, the bed cannot be changed, but the guest has to be put according to the bed, as if the bed does not exist for the guest. But the guest exists for the bed. And it is very rare, almost impossible to find a man to fit with a ready-made bed. The average person does not exist, remember. The average person is a fiction. And the bed was made for the average person. The king was a mathematician. Great calculation has gone into it. He had counted the height of all the citizens of his capital. And then the height was divided by the number of all the citizens. He had come to a fixed average. Now there were small children in the capital, young people, old people, pygmies, giants. But the average was a totally different phenomenon. There was not a single person in his whole capital who was really average. I have never come across the average person. The average person is a fiction. So whosoever was going to be the guest was in trouble. If he was shorter than the bed, then the king had great wrestlers who will pull the man to size. That must have been the beginning of Rolfing. Either Rolf must have learnt it from that king. Of course, each guest died. But that was not the king's fault. He was doing everything with best of intentions in the world. When you have a certain attitude towards life, Margaret, you will miss life itself. Life is vast. uncontainable in any attitude, impossible to put it into a certain definition. Yes, your attitude may cover a certain aspect, but it will be only an aspect. And the tendency of the mind is to proclaim its aspect as the whole. And the moment the aspect is claimed as the whole, you have missed the very connection with life. Then you will live surrounded by your attitudes in a kind of cocoon, encapsulated, and you will be miserable. And then all your so-called religions will be very happy, because that's what they have been telling to you, that life is misery. Buddha says, the birth is misery, the youth is misery, the old age is misery, the death is misery, the whole life is nothing but a long, long tragedy. If you start with attitudes, you will find Buddha absolutely correct. You will be a proof. But I want to tell you that life is not misery. And I don't agree with Buddha at all. Life becomes a misery, but that is your doing. Otherwise, life is eternal joy. But to know that eternal joy, you have to come open-hearted, open-handed. Don't approach life with your fists closed, clenched. Open your hands. Go into life with immense innocence. Attitudes are cunning. You have already decided, without tasting, without experiencing, without living, you have already arrived to certain conclusions. And of course, if those conclusions are there already in you a priori, you will find them confirmed by life. Not that life confirms them, but your whole mind will try to find out ways and means, arguments, data to support. Mind is like a sponge. It goes on sucking. It is a parasite. Once there is a center of a certain a priori conclusion, then that center starts becoming crystallized. A man came to me who has been working for years for a certain hypothesis. In many countries of the world, particularly in the West, and more particularly in America, the number 13 is not thought to be good. There are hotels in America where the 13th floor does not exist. From 12th floor, you simply come to the 14th. The number 13th is avoided. No room has the number 13. From 12th, you immediately reach to the 14th. Because nobody wants to live in the 13th room on the 13th floor. a great fear, the idea that the number 13 has something evil in it. And this man was working and collecting all kinds of data. And he has collected really a huge mountainous support. How many accidents happen on the date 13th every month? How many people die on the date 13th? How many people commit suicide? How many people murder? How many people go mad? And he was showing his great thesis to me. And he said, "What do you say?" I said, "You do one thing more. You have put so much energy into it. Now try one thing more. Now find out what happens on 12th. And you will come to the same data. Because on 12th also people go mad, commit suicide, murder, rob. Everything happens every day. But if you have a certain attitude fixed, then you will choose according to that attitude. And of course, when you have so much information and argument, you feel certain that your attitude is right. Margaret, I teach you a life without any attitudes. This is one of the fundamentals of my experience. If you really want to know that which is, then drop all philosophy, all ism, then go open-handed, utterly naked into the sun to see what it is. In the past it was thought that our senses are doors. The reality reaches from our centers to our innermost being. Now, the latest researches show something else. Our senses are not just doors. They are guards also. Only 2% of information is allowed to pass in. 98% is prevented outside. Anything that goes against your idea of life is prevented. And only 2% filters in. Now to live a life of 2% only is not to live at all. When one can live 100%, why decide to live for 2% only? Margaret, you asked me, is it important to have some kind of attitude towards life? Not only that it is not important, it is dangerous to have any attitude towards life. Why not allow life to have its dance, its song, without any expectations? Why can't we live without expectations? Why can't we see that which is in its purity? Why should we impose ourselves upon it? And nobody is going to be the loser. If you impose upon life, you are the only loser. from London comes the story of the three professors of literature who, while returning from lunch, encountered several ladies of pleasure who were patrolling the street en masse. What might one call such a congregation? Mused the first professor, a Shakespearean specialist, a florist of strumpets. The second professor, being an authority on the novels of Anthony Trollope, naturally contributed a chapter of Trollope's. But the best description came from the youngest and the least specialized of the professors. He called the ladies an anthology of prose. It is better not to label life. It is better not to give it a structure. It is better to leave it open-ended. It is better not to categorize it, not to labelize it. You will have a more beautiful experience of things. You will have a more cosmic experience of things, because things are not really divided. The existence is one orgasmic whole. It is one organic unit. The smallest grade of grass, the smallest leaf in a poor tree is as significant as the biggest star. The smallest thing is also the biggest, because it is all oneness. It is one spectrum. The moment you start dividing, you start creating arbitrary lines, definitions. And that's the way how one goes on missing life and the mystery of it. We all have attitudes. That is our anguish. We all look from a certain standpoint. Hence our life becomes poor, because every aspect at the most can be one-dimensional. And life is multidimensional. You have to be more liquid, more fluid, more melting and merging. You are not to be an observer. There is nothing to be solved. Don't take life as a problem. It is a tremendously beautiful mystery. Drink of it. It is pure wine. Be a drunkard with it. A successful cloak and suitor had finally found the girl of his dreams. And he made preparations for a wedding. The garment district would never forget. His own designers prepared a wedding gown for the bride of the finest imported silks and satins. And his own material raiment was truly a sight to behold. The affair was nothing less than breathtaking. No expense had been spared. Then, as the newlyweds were about to embark on their honeymoon trip to Canada, an urgent message arrived in the form of a telegram. "It is from my partner," the groom explained. "Urgent business. I will have to attend to it immediately." "But what about our honeymoon?" the bride asked tearfully. "Business comes first," he said. "But you go ahead. I will catch a later plane and be there by tonight." "But what if you can't make it by tonight?" she moaned. "Then," he blustered, "start without me." A businessman has his own philosophy, his own attitudes. The scientist has his own attitudes. Everybody is living in a small prison of his own attitudes. My effort here is to bring you out of your imprisonment. Hence, I don't teach you any doctrine. I don't give you any dogma. I don't give you any creed to live by. I'm simply trying to help you to be unburdened with all the nonsense which has been imposed upon you for centuries. If you can put aside the mountainous weight of the past, if you can start living as if you are the first man, only then there is a possibility that you may come to know what godliness is, what freedom is, what joy is. Otherwise, misery is going to be your lot. And naturally, sooner or later, you will agree with the pessimist attitude of Buddha, that all is suffering, all is pain. I absolutely deny it, because my own experience is just the opposite. All is bliss, all is benediction. But it depends on you, how you approach life. Guard it with certain spectacles on your eyes, or unguard it in deep trust, in love. The second question, Bhagwan, in the past, all famous artists have been well known for their bohemian style of life. Bhagwan, please can you say something about creativity and discipline? Santos Isne. The bohemian life is the only life worth living. All other kinds of lives are only lukewarm. There are more ways of committing slow suicide than ways of living life passionately and intensely. In the past, it was inevitable that the artist has to live in rebellion, because creativity is the greatest rebellion in existence. If you want to create, you have to get rid of all conditionings. Otherwise, your creativity will be nothing but copying. It will be just a carbon copy. You can be creative only if you are an individual. You cannot create as part of the mob psychology. The mob psychology is uncreative. It lives a life of drag. It knows no dance, no song, no joy. It is mechanical. Of course, there are few things you will get from the society only if you are mechanical. Respectability you will get. Honors you will get. Universities will confer D-lits on you. Countries will give you gold medals. You may become finally a Nobel laureate. But this whole thing is ugly. A real man of genius will discard all this nonsense, because this is bribery. Giving Nobel Prize to a person simply means your services to the establishment have been respected. That you are honored because you have been a good slave, obedient. That you have not gone astray. That you have followed the well-trodden path. The creator cannot follow the well-trodden path. He has to search his own way. He has to inquire in the jungles of life. He has to go alone. He has to be a drop out from the mob mind, from the collective psychology. The collective mind is the lowest mind in the world. Even the so-called idiots are a little bit superior than the collective idiots. But the collectivity has its own bribes. It respects people, honors people. If they go on insisting that the way of the collective mind is the only right way, it was out of sheer necessity that in the past the creators of all kinds, the painters, the dancers, the musicians, the poets, the sculptors, had to renounce respectability. They had to live a kind of bohemian life, the life of a vagabond. That was the only possibility for them to be creative. This need not be so in the future. If you understand me, if you feel what I am saying has a truth in it, then in the future everybody should live individually and there will be no need for a bohemian life. The bohemian life is a byproduct of a fixed, orthodox, conventional, respectable life. My effort is to destroy the collective mind and to make each individual free to be himself or herself. Then there is no problem. Then you can live as you want to live. In fact, humanity will be really born only the day the individual is respected in his rebellion. Humanity is still not born. It is still in the womb. What you see as humanity is only a very hocus-focus phenomenon. Unless we give individual freedom to each person, absolute freedom to each person, to be himself, to exist in his own way, of course, he has not to interfere with anybody. That is part of freedom. Nobody should interfere with anybody. But in the past, everybody has been poking his nose in everybody else's affair. Even things which are absolutely private, which have nothing to do with the society. For example, you fall in love with a woman. What that has got to do with the society? It is purely a personal phenomenon. It is not of the marketplace. If two persons are agreeing to commune in love, the society should not come in, but the society comes in with all its paraphernalia, in direct ways, in indirect ways. The policeman will stand between the lovers. The magistrate will stand between the lovers. And if that is not enough, then the societies have created a super policeman, the god, who will take care of you. The idea of the god is that of a peeping Tom, who does not even allow you privacy in your bathroom, who goes on looking from the keyhole, watching what you are doing. This is ugly. All the religions of the world say God continuously watches you. This is ugly. What kind of God is this? Has he got no other business? Watching everybody, following everybody, seems to be the supreme most detective. Humanity needs a new soil, the soil of freedom. Bohemianism was a reaction, a necessary reaction. But if my vision succeeds, then there will be no bohemianism, because there will be no so-called collective mind trying to dominate people. Then everybody will be at ease with himself. Of course, you are not to interfere with anybody. But as far as your life is concerned, you have to live it on your own terms. Then only there is creativity. Creativity is the fragrance of the individual freedom. You ask me, Sneh, Bhagwan, please, can you say something about creativity and discipline? Discipline is a beautiful word, but has been misused as all other beautiful words have been misused in the past. The word discipline comes from the same root as the word disciple. The root meaning of the word is a process of learning. One who is ready to learn is a disciple. And the process of being ready to learn is discipline. The knowledgeable person is never ready to learn, because he already thinks he knows. He is very much centered in his so-called knowledge. His knowledge is nothing but a nourishment for his ego. He cannot be a disciple, he cannot be in true discipline. Socrates says, I know only one thing, that I know nothing. That is the beginning of discipline. When you don't know anything, of course, a great longing to inquire, explore, investigate arises. And the moment you start learning, another factor follows inevitably. Whatsoever you have learned has to be dropped continuously. Otherwise, it will become knowledge. And knowledge will prevent further learning. The real man of discipline never accumulates. Each moment he dies to whatsoever he has come to know, and again becomes ignorant. That ignorance is really luminous. I agree with Dionysius when he calls ignorance luminous. It is one of the most beautiful experiences in existence to be in a state of luminous not knowing. When you are in that state of not knowing, you are open. There is no barrier. You are ready to explore. The Hindus cannot do it. They are already knowledgeable. The Mohammedans cannot do it. The Christians cannot do it. My sannyasins can do it. For the simple reason, because I am not imparting knowledge. On the contrary, I am destroying your knowledge. Hence it happens every day. Every day I receive many letters, many questions. One friend has come from the West. He says for 3-4 years he has been reading my books. And he was so much excited. He was in such great love with me that he wanted to come somehow as quickly as possible. And now he has been able to manage to come. But here he feels frustrated. He was 4 years in deep love with me. And now he says, I cannot say the same. Because you are so shocking to me. You irritate me. You annoy me. You go on hammering on my cherished ideas. It is easy to read a book because the book is in your hands. I am not in your hands. You can interpret the book according to your ideas. You cannot interpret me according to your ideas. I will make so much trouble for you. He was not in love with me. He was in love with his own ideas. But because he was finding support from my books, he lived in an illusion. But with me, illusions are bound to be shattered. I am here to shatter all illusions. Yes, it will irritate you. It will annoy you. That's my very way of functioning and working. I will sabotage you from your very roots. Unless you are totally destroyed as a mind, there is no hope for you. Discipline has been misinterpreted. People have been telling others to discipline their life, to do this, not to do that. Thousands of shoulds and should nots have been imposed on men. And when a man lives with thousands of shoulds and should nots, he cannot be creative. He is a prisoner. Everywhere he will come across a wall. The creative person has to dissolve all shoulds and should nots. He needs freedom and space, vast space. He needs the whole sky and all the stars. Only then his innermost spontaneity can start growing. So remember, my meaning of discipline is not that of 10 commandments. I am not giving you any discipline. I am simply giving you an insight how to remain learning and never become knowledgeable. Your discipline has to come from your very heart. It has to be yours. And there is a great difference. When somebody else gives you the discipline, it can never fit you. It will be wearing somebody else's clothes. Either they will be too loose or too tight. And you will always feel within them a little bit silly. Muhammad has given a discipline to the Mohammedans. It may have been good for himself, but it cannot be good for anybody else. Buddha has given the discipline to millions of Buddhists. It may have been good for himself. It cannot be good for anybody else. A discipline is an individual phenomenon. Whenever you borrow it, you start living according to set principles, dead principles, and life is never dead. Life is constantly changing. Each moment, life is a flux. Heraclitus is right, you cannot step in the same river twice. In fact, I myself would like to say, you cannot step in the same river even once. The river is so fast moving. One has to be alert, watchful to each situation and its nuances. And one has to respond to the situation according to the moment, not according to any ready-made answers given by others. Do you see the stupidity of humanity? 5,000 years before Manu gave the discipline for the Hindus, and they are still following it. 3,000 years before Moses gave the discipline to the Jews, and they are still following. Five thousand years before Adinatha gave his discipline to the Jainas, and they are still following. The whole world is being driven crazy by these disciplines. They are out of date. They should have been worried long, long ago. You are carrying corpses, and those corpses are stinking. And when you live surrounded by corpses, what kind of life you can have? I teach you the moment and the freedom of the moment and the responsibility of the moment. One thing may be right this moment and may become wrong the next moment. Don't try to be consistent, otherwise you will be dead. Only dead people are consistent. Try to be alive with all its inconsistencies and live each moment without any reference to the past, without any reference to the future either. Live the moment in the context of the moment, and your response will be total. And that totality has beauty. And that totality is creativity. Then whatsoever you do will have a beauty of its own. The third question. Bhagwan, I have discovered that I am just bored with myself and I feel no juice. You have said to accept ourselves whatever we are. I am not able to accept life. knowing that I am missing something of joy inside, what to do? Bab Luka, we hear there is a new type of tranquilizer that does not relax you, just makes you dig being tense. You try it. Try it and try it and try it again. Be an American. But not more than 3 times. try it and try it again. And then stop. Because there is no point in being silly. You say, I have discovered that I am just bored with myself. This is a great discovery. Yes, I mean it. Very few people are aware that they are bored. And they are bored. Utterly bored. Everybody else knows except themselves. To know that one is bored is a great beginning. Now, a few implications have to be understood. Man is the only animal who feels boredom. It is a great prerogative. It is part of the dignity of human beings. Have you seen any buffalo bored? Any donkey bored? They are not bored. Boredom simply means that the way you are living is wrong. Hence, it can become a great event, the understanding that I am bored and something has to be done. Some transformation is needed. So don't think that it is bad that you are feeling bored. It is a good sign, a good beginning. A very auspicious beginning. But don't stop there. Why one feels bored? One feels bored because one has been living in dead patterns given by others to you. Renounce those patterns. Come out of those patterns. Start living on your own. Only the authentic person is not bored. The pseudo person is bound to be bored. The Christian will be bored. The Jaina will be bored. The Parsi will be bored. The communist will be bored. Because they are dividing their life into parts. Their real life remains repressed. And they start pretending an unreal life. It is unreal life that creates boredom. If you are doing the thing you are meant to do, you will never be bored. The day I left my home for the university, my parents, my father, my family people, all wanted me to become a scientist. There was much more future for a scientist or a doctor at least or an engineer. I refused absolutely. I said, I am going to do what I want to do because I don't want to live a bored life. As a scientist, I may succeed. I may have respectability, money, power, prestige. But deep down, I will remain bored. Because that is not what I ever wanted to do. They were shocked. Because they could not see any prospects in studying philosophy. Philosophy is the poorest subject in the universities. Reluctantly they agreed, knowing that I am wasting my future. But finally they recognized they were wrong. It is not a question of money, power and prestige. It is a question of what intrinsically you want to do. Do it. Irrespective of the results. And your boredom will disappear. You must be following others' ideas. You must be doing things in a right way. You must be doing things as they should be done. These are the foundation stones of boredom. The whole humanity is bored. Because the person who would have been a mystic is a mathematician. The person who would have been a mathematician is a politician. The person who would have been a poet is a businessman. Everybody is somewhere else. Nobody is where he should be. One has to risk. Boredom can disappear in a single moment if you are ready to risk. You ask me, Babluka, I have discovered that I am just bored with myself. You are bored with myself because you have not been sincere to yourself. You have not been honest to yourself. You have not been respectful to your own being. And you say, I feel no juice. From where you can feel juice? Juice flows only when you are doing the thing that you wanted to do. Whatsoever it is, Vincent van Gogh was immensely happy, just painting. Not a single painting was sold. Nobody ever appreciated him. And he was dying. He was hungry. Because his brother was giving him only a small amount of money so that he can at least manage to survive. 4 days he will fast, and 3 days in the week he will eat. He had to fast for those 4 days, because from where he is going to get his canvases and paints and brushes? But he was immensely happy. Juices were flowing. He died only when he was 33. He committed suicide. But his suicide is far better, Bab Luka, than your so-called life. Because he committed suicide only when he had painted the thing that he wanted to paint. The day he finished a painting of sunset, which was his longest desire, he wrote a letter that my work is done, I am fulfilled, I am leaving this world immensely contented. He committed suicide, but I will not call it suicide. He lived totally. He burned his life candle from both the ends together in tremendous intensity. Bab Luka, you may live 100 years, but your life will be just a dry bone, a weight, dead weight. You say, Bhagwan, you have said to accept ourselves whatever we are. I am not able to accept life, knowing that I am missing something of joy inside. When I say accept yourself, I am not saying accept your pattern of life. Don't try to misunderstand me. When I say accept yourself, I am saying reject everything else. Accept yourself. But you must have interpreted it in your own way. That's how things go. The Martian landed his saucer in Manhattan and immediately upon emerging was approached by a panhandler. Mister, said the man, can I have a dime? The Martian asked, what is a dime? The panhandler thought a minute and then said, you are right, can I have a quarter? I have not said what you have understood. Reject all that has been imposed on you. I'm not saying accept it. Accept your innermost core, which you have brought from the beyond. And then you will not feel that you are missing something. The moment you accept yourself, without any conditions, suddenly an outburst of joy happens. Juices start flowing. Life really becomes ecstatic. A certain young man's friends thought he was dead, but he was only in a state of coma. When just in time to avoid being buried, he showed signs of life. He was asked how it felt to be dead. Dead? He exclaimed, I was not dead. I knew all the time what was going on. And I knew I was not dead too. because my feet were cold and I was hungry. But how did that fact make you think you were still alive? Asked one of the curious. Well, I knew that if I was in heaven, I would not be hungry. And if I was in the other place, my feet would not be cold. One thing is certain, Bab Luka, that you are still not dead. You are hungry, your feet are cold. Just get up and do a little jogging. A poor man, lacking education and all social graces, fell in love with the daughter of a millionaire. She invited him home to meet her parents at their elegant mansion. The man was intimidated by the rich furnishings, the servants and all the other signs of wealth, but somehow he managed to appear relaxed until it came to dinner time. Seated at the massive dinner table, mellow with the effects of wine, he farted loudly. The girl's father looked up and stared at his dog, which was lying at the poor man's feet. "Rover," he said in a menacing tone. The poor man was relieved that the blame had been put on the dog, and so a few minutes later he farted again. His host looked at the dog and again said, "Rover," in a louder voice. A few minutes later he farted a third time. The rich man's face wrinkled in rage. He bellowed, "Rover, get the hell out of here before he shits all over you." Bab Luka, there is still time. Get out of the imprisonment in which you have lived up to now. It only needs a little courage. Just a little courage of the gambler. And there is nothing to lose, remember. You can lose only your chains. You can lose your boredom. You can lose this constant feeling inside you that something is missing. What else there is to lose? Get out of the rut and accept your own being. Against Moses, Jesus, Buddha, Mahavira, Krishna, accept yourself. Your responsibility is not towards Buddha or Zarathustra or Kabir or Nanak. Your responsibility is only towards you. Be responsible. And when I use the word responsible, please remember, don't misinterpret it. I'm not talking about duties, responsibilities. I'm simply using the word in the literal sense. Respond to reality. Be responsible. You must have lived an irresponsible life, fulfilling all kinds of responsibilities which are others expecting you to. What is there to lose? You are bored. This is a good situation. you are missing the juice. What more you need to get out of the prison? Jump out of it. Don't look back. They say, think twice before you jump. I say, jump first and then think as much as you want. The fourth question. Bhagwan, can a madman become a Buddha? Ananda Navneet, only a madman can become a Buddha. The so-called sane people, at the most, can become Buddhists, but not Buddhas. They can become Christians, but not Christ. Only a madman. My invitation is for the mad people of the world. I am a madman's guide to enlightenment. A group of philosophers from the Russian prison decided to escape. They had a duplicate key, so they waited for the night to make their escape. At midnight, one of them went to open the door, but came back after a few minutes with a long, sad face. "What happened?" asked all the others. "Well, our plan is useless. We can't escape. The crazy night watchman has forgotten to close the door, and I can't use the key." Philosophers cannot become Buddhas. It needs guts to become a Buddha. Jesus was hanging on the cross when a philosopher passed by. He stopped, looked at Jesus and asked, "What are you doing up there?" Jesus nodded his head to the left and right and said, "I'm hanging out with friends." The philosopher continued, "Well, if you want, I could get a ladder and take you down." "I would appreciate that," Jesus replied. Half an hour later, the philosopher came back with a ladder, climbed up to the cross, screwed the nails out of the right hand, then out of the left hand. Jesus fell headlong, screaming, "You idiot! Next time start with the feet." The last question. Bhagwan, I want to get lost utterly and ultimately into absolute love. What should I do? Dharma, the very idea of getting lost utterly, ultimately, absolutely, is demanding too much. be a little more human. Don't aspire for the impossible. The impossible has been driving people into unnecessary hysteria. And we have been burdened with impossible values for centuries. And we have learned these words. And we go on repeating these words parrot-like, without even taking in the significance. Be human. Don't aspire for perfection in any way. Because all perfectionism is neurosis. Be human and accept all the frailties and limitations of human beings. Why should you want to be lost utterly? For what? What you are going to gain out of it? If it can be managed, it is good that it cannot be managed. For argument's sake, I am saying, if it can be managed, you will come again. That now I am feeling very lonely, utterly lost. Absolutely lost. Ultimately lost. You will start hankering to go back, to have a little more spice of life. It is good to meet and merge. But why make it something ultimate? Why bring such meaningless words? Is it not enough to melt for a moment and then be back home? Then there is a rhythm. You melt, you enjoy the melting, then again you are back. It creates a rhythm. And rhythm is always richer. If you are simply dissolved forever, there will be no rhythm, no music, no dance. It will be really death, not life. My whole approach is to teach you to be human. For centuries you have been told to be superhuman. I rejoice in your humanness. To me, humanness is synonymous with godliness. It is perfectly beautiful to be lost once in a while and found again, so that you can lose yourself again. Create a rhythm of getting lost, of finding oneself again. Life is a music. And the music is possible only if both things continue. Otherwise, it will be monotonous. Dharmo, I cannot help you in getting lost absolutely, ultimately, utterly. I love the moment. I love the immediacy of the moment. I am very averse to words like ultimate. They are far away words. They don't have much meaning in them. They are pretentious words. The absolute is not of any significance. A rose flower is of far more significance. It is not absolute. In the morning it grows, by the evening it is gone. That's its beauty. It is momentary. It is a miracle. The ultimate rose will be synthetic, plastic. It will be there forever. But because it will not be able to die, it will not be alive either. Life has to learn this synchronicity of losing and then coming back to yourself and losing again. The closeness of love and the distance. Each distance in love again creates a longing to be close. If you are stuck together and you cannot separate, your love life will become a nightmare. Meditate over this story, Dharmo. It is a beautiful parable. Only I can say it is a parable. Rosalie Mazzoli, Ni Adelstein, had married a midget. For a while they were getting along all right. But one day Rosalie showed up in domestic relations court and demanded she be granted divorce from little Harry. Surely, Mrs. Mazzoli, you knew your husband was a midget when you married him, questioned the judge. Why are you now desirous of leaving him? Did not you anticipate the problems of this marriage you would encounter? Ah, Your Honor, sobbed Rosalie, how was I to know? Everything is wonderful except for sex. Sex? Repeated the judge. What has his being a midget got to do with sex? Well, she continued tearfully, when we are nose to nose, his toes are in it. When we are toes to nose, his nose is in it. And when he is in it, he disappears altogether. And I, Your Honor, I get so lonely. There is no need to be utterly, ultimately, absolutely lost. Be relaxed. Once in a while get lost and that is good. Lose yourself and find yourself again and again. This is a beautiful drama, this existence of losing and finding. And drop all these words of ultimate, absolute, perfect. These all words are inventions of the philosophers. Life is immediate. Life is always now and here. And live it with all the frailty of a human being, with all the frailty of a rose flower. And you will come to know the greatest splendor in the moment, not in eternity. It is always now, and it is always here. Don't condemn the momentary. Rejoice in it. Rejoice to abundance.